Okay, all set. Thank you. Thank you, Jim, for that introduction, and thank you also for inviting me today, and which helps me a lot actually to be able to share my story in sobriety. So my sobriety date is, oh, my name is Bill. My last name is Scott. I grew up in Buffalo, in Kenmore, to be exact. And my sobriety date is January 3rd, 1984. So I came in, as you can imagine, at a pretty young age. I was 15. I had just turned 15 a month earlier. And it's not at all an exaggeration to say that I owe my entire life to AA and to sobriety and to God, to all of you, to the fellowship. I've had periods where I wasn't going to that many meetings, and sort of forgot how much I owed to the fellowship, and so it makes me especially doubly grateful to be able to be here and share my story with all of you today. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. Maybe I'll say briefly. I've got a several home groups here in Pittsburgh. I moved to Pittsburgh in 2005. I left Buffalo though in 1994, so I haven't actually been in Buffalo for a while. But I had a home group in Buffalo, the University Men's Discussion Group, on Mondays and Fridays, and so I still try to get back there and visit whenever I'm in town visiting. And I'm so happy that they changed their start time to 7:30 p.m. Finally, it was always a little bit late for me to go at 8:30, but I love seeing my friends there. I'll just start at the beginning. So I grew up in a family, a very loving family, where there was a lot of drinking, and it wasn't always necessarily alcoholic drinking. I guess it seemed to me to just be normal, my parents liked to entertain a lot, and so they had a lot of house parties and dinner parties, and then in the summer, they used to love to throw keg parties with clams and beer, and I just thought that that was something that all that was the adult world. That's what grown-ups did, and it looked like a lot of fun, and it looked like, this is what I have to look forward to as a grown-up. But of course, I couldn't, wait until I was older, so I started stealing, drinking whatever I could find that was in glasses left over. So my first drink, I don't actually remember what my first drink was, but it was a something in the bottom of a beer bottle, probably, or some kind of glasses that were laying around after a party. And that's how I started drinking, and how I got sort of the sort of obsession, I guess, with it, because I started to want more and more from that. And I'm not trying to, blame my parents or blame my upbringing or my family for my alcoholism. I don't know why I drank, or I wanted to drink the way I wanted to. I wasn't, but I knew. It's funny. I knew even at a very young age, and I mean like 7, 8, 9 years old, when I was really starting to drink. I knew that other kids my age weren't doing that, and so it wasn't normal. In a way, I didn't talk about it with my friends. I didn't talk about it, obviously, with my parents or with any family members. I just kept it to myself, and I think that pattern of drinking, and isolation or secrecy and lying, always went hand in hand to me. Drinking for me was about isolating. It was about doing things on the down low, sort of out of sight, out of mind, kind of from anyone else. And in part because I think I could sense that this wasn't, whatever my urge to want to drink, my obsession about it. I could tell other kids weren't talking about this kind of thing. But also just because I was a kid, and I was afraid of getting in trouble for doing something that I wasn't supposed to do. So that's how I drank, and I actually even convinced my parents that I was really into camping, and I got them to buy me a tent so that I could set up the tent in the backyard and tell them that I was going to have like these backyard tent adventures, and I would really just steal a whole bunch of booze from, from our liquor cabinet or from my, friends' liquor cabinets and bring that out to the tent with me. So it was a place where I could drink and not be seen. So that's how I really started to drink a lot was sort of on my own, in this tent. And for some reason too, I thought I had this real conviction. I don't know again where it came from, but I had this conviction that I better get good at this because if I want to keep up with, with the rest of the world when I get older, I'm going to have to outdrink everybody and hold my liquor. So I sort of thought of my drinking too as, I was getting ready for drinking in a social way, but that never quite happened. I had all the kind of typical hallmarks though of also just, I was just wanting to get wasted in any way I could. The first rock concert that my parents took me to was the Bee Gees concert in 19, I think 78, and it was at the Memorial Auditorium. I don't think they call it that anymore. Maybe it doesn't exist downtown. And I remember when the band was about to start, the lights dimmed and the people sitting in the row in front of us lit something and started smoking it, and it didn't smell like cigarettes. And my mother turned to me and she said, "Billy, they're smoking marijuana." And that got me so excited that for the entire Bee Gees concert, I was leaning forward trying to inhale as much of the smoke as I could to try to get a contact buzz off of the pot smoke. And I still remember the concert, but I also remember vividly trying to get high the whole time, breathing in the smoke. And it didn't really quite work, and I was a little disappointed, and I still enjoyed myself. But that was like, that was that's my first rock concert basically. And I would do stuff like trying to drink, when I couldn't get booze when I wasn't near it, I would try to get, I would just try to get drunk on like mouthwash or something like that around the house. Anything I could find that had alcohol in it. But basically most of my booze came from either my house or from other people's houses. And I thought I was good at also kind of hiding the traces of what I was doing. The other thing that I noticed about myself that was kind of seemed to be different was that I didn't realize that this wasn't totally normal drinking, but I realized that whenever I started, no matter how much I had, I couldn't stop until it was all gone. And that often meant that I drank till I passed out or I got really, really sick. And a couple of times then I was that's part of my story as well. I was hospitalized for poisoning myself. Because I couldn't drink either. I was, drinking so much in blackouts. And anyway, but I always thought when I wasn't drinking at all, I was never a daily drinker. I couldn't be as a kid. But I was trying to imagine where I was going to get, my next drink or how I was going to steal more. So I obsessed about it. But the one thing I'm grateful for was that because I was so young, I was never, I never felt physically addicted in that way. And so giving up drinking for me did not involve, a huge physical issue, but it involved a lot of mental issues. Anyway, all of this led up to, one moment I discovered that I was building tolerance. I had a lot of tolerance, and I didn't seem to be able to get drunk. And so one day, I was in the sixth grade. I was 9 or 10. I can't remember which now, but I think I was maybe just turned 10. But I came home from school and on a school bus, and I decided to myself, okay, I really want to get drunk this afternoon. I really want to get loaded. And so the only person home was my sister watching TV. I go in from school, I go right to our liquor cabinet, and I just start drinking as much as I possibly could. And then I went upstairs. I started to feel a little queasy, passed out in my room, and woke up in the hospital. And I woke up and I learned that I was in a coma and I needed to get my stomach pumped there. They pumped out, I don't know, 2 gallons of whatever, 3 gallons, I don't know, an enormous amount of booze. And I didn't know what I was doing in terms of, I just, wanted to get smashed. And so I was, mixing everything I could get my hands on. And it's funny because when I came out of it in the hospital, my first memory in from this first hospitalization was the doctors leaning over me, looking into my face and asking me, this is what they said, Who did this to you? Who did this to you? All right. And when I heard that question, I thought, well, clearly they don't think I did this to myself. All right. Otherwise, they wouldn't be putting it that way. So I better give them some names of people. So I immediately thought of, like, who were the troublemakers at school who would do something like this to me? Who are the kids who are always going to the principal's office and stuff? And so I gave them like three names of kids. And they wrote them down, and I guess they followed up on this, but and the kids actually got in a little bit of trouble, but it was pretty quickly evident to everybody that I was making this whole story up because I couldn't keep my story straight. So then other people came in, like some detective came in and asked me, so tell me more about these kids at school and how it all happened, and I told the story differently. And anyway, I think within a couple of days, it was pretty clear to everybody that I did this to myself. But my folks didn't want to talk to me about it. Really, no adults wanted to talk to me about what happened. And I think that maybe people felt, well, if we don't talk about this, it'll just disappear or whatever. It's just an isolated incident. So I lied. I thought I successfully lied my way out of that. And I thought, actually, after that, when I got out of the hospital, I remember that was my first resolution to quit drinking. I realized, I thought, okay, I'm something about alcohol in me. They don't. I can't handle it. It doesn't work. It's going to kill me if I keep drinking the way I'm drinking. So I better just stop completely. And so I made a resolution. I'm going to stop for the rest of my life. Right? We all know what that looks like. So, but that was my first resolution. I'm not going to drink ever again for the rest of my life. Even the fact that, I'm a 10-year-old making this my first resolution to quit drinking, I should have been a wake-up call for me that something is unusual here. But that's what I did. And just like we hear a lot of, similar kind of stories of, a few months went by, I don't know how long, maybe 6 months. And I was up late at night and I opened the refrigerator to get something to drink. And I saw a can of beer in the refrigerator. It was a Rolling Rock. And I thought, what is a friggin' Rolling Rock going to hurt? How is that going to hurt me? Surely I can have a can of beer and it's not going to kill me. Right. So I drank a little bit of this Rolling Rock, and I was really happy to discover that I lost all of my tolerance, and that I was starting to feel like buzzed off of a half a can of beer, and I thought, well, this is fantastic because now I won't take as much for me to get wasted, and my motive really was just to try to get away from the world, is away from people, away from reality as fast as possible. That's what alcohol did for me. I'm not the kind of I wasn't ever the kind of drinker where alcohol helped me to relate to people or helped me to loosen up at parties or helped me to talk to anybody or meet girls or anything like that. Just the opposite. When I drank, if there were other people around, and as I got a little bit older, I started drinking around other people, friends and adults and things, and I turned into a kind of a monster. So I had a kind of I really identify with that part in the Big Book that says we're like Jekyll and Hyde, because when I was drinking, I was a totally different person, and I was a real mean kind of vindictive, insulting, offensive person to everyone around me. I was also doing, this isn't a huge part of my relation to alcohol, but at this time in my life, I was 12, 13. I was starting to get in with a wrong crowd of friends in middle school and stealing a lot of things, in particular, auto parts. I don't know why I like to steal things off of cars, and for no reason at all. I guess someday I was going to sell the stuff and make money from it, but I didn't know how to do that. So I was just kind of in this mode of stealing things. But I stole a lot, and that was all part of my sort of secret life that went along with, the secrets I was keeping around drinking. So that was a part of my story in this sense. And in a way, that was an important, it ended up being an important, part of my sort of depression that I was experiencing when I got busted, my dad is an attorney, and he told me that this was a felony that I had committed, how much stealing I had been doing, and that I could go to like juvenile prison or something like that. And then I thought, like, man, oh man, I really screwed up here, and I'm a piece of dirt, right? Like I'm anyway, I don't want to dwell too much in this time of my life, but I'll just kind of get to the chase here, where my parents had were friends with a family in France, and we decided they had some kids, and they decided to do a sort of child swap, and I was going to spend the summer in France with this French family, and they were going to send their daughter to Buffalo. So I did that, and that was that allowed me to drink in a way that I could never drink before. I could go into stores, I could buy stuff, it was cheap. Nobody was asking for ID or anything, and I could really drink as much as I wanted. And what was even more sort of pleasant for me to discover about living in France with this family was they thought of themselves, and they really were sort of wine connoisseurs. And so they said, you know, when I got there, Billy, you need to learn about wine. You need to be able to go back to Buffalo and teach people about, you know, all the different kinds of French wines. And so we're going to help you to do that. So of course I was, you know, thrilled to tell them, yeah, of course I want to learn about wine. Teach me everything you know, right? And I just wanted to get wasted the whole time, you know. So I was, that's kind of how I managed through that summer. But I did so much more drinking there than I could ever do before in Buffalo. And so when I got when I did get back to the States, I was starting to feel really depressed, not just because I was in trouble a lot, but just because my life I felt was you know, one huge lie based on a lie, based on other lies, you know, and I just couldn't keep it all straight. And I felt like I was living a really a life apart from the rest of humanity, and I felt like the universe was out to get me, and that I had been given a bad deal in life. Nobody in my family loved me. I hated all of them, and in fact, you know, the rest of humanity could go jump off a cliff as far as I was concerned, because they were all doing me wrong. And so I was starting to have suicide fantasies, really serious suicide fantasies, and for a long time, for I guess about a period of about 6 months for me. This was the beginning of my second year of high school, and where that sort of culminated was right after Christmas. This is in 1983, and then New Year's 1984. I was about to go back to school after the sort of holiday break, and I really was nervous about it. I had tests and homework and all sorts of stuff that I wasn't doing, and I was nervous about it all and stressed and. And I was up and I couldn't sleep, and it was about, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And I couldn't go to bed, and I thought, I need a nightcap. So I'm gonna go. So I went downstairs. Everyone in my family was asleep, and I thought, I need the strongest thing I can get my hands on. And I found an unopened bottle that had the seal on it of this bourbon Wild Turkey. And that's very, very strong stuff, I thought. I looked at it, I thought, well, this will do the job. I cracked the seal, opened the bottle, and I filled up like a kind of a half of a jam jar, like for the, where you put preserves, because I thought, well, this is about maybe a shot. It was a, you know, a lot of booze, and I thought, well, I better drink it as fast as possible and just go right back to bed so that it can, you know, do its work and I can get to sleep. That was my thinking. But of course, I slugged it down. I felt a hole burning in my stomach. And then I immediately started to feel good, and I thought, well, I'll watch some TV. So I go and I turn on the TV, and then I thought, I need more. I need more. And my last memory then was crawling back to the liquor cabinet on my hands and knees, to go for this bottle, and then drinking it straight out of the bottle. That was it. And then I woke up again in the hospital. And what had happened was, my folks asked me later when I woke up in the hospital, what it was I was drinking, and I told them it was Wild Turkey. And they went home and they looked. There wasn't a drop left in the bottle when they looked at the bottle. So in a blackout, I drank probably, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of that bottle that night. And when I came to in the hospital, well. I'll back up for a second. First of all, nobody thought I was going to come to. I had fallen into a coma that was more severe and deeper. It's the kind that where you're like almost brain dead, and that you're just on life support, and they basically pull the plug on you. And it was a miracle that I was even found. All of this happened at like maybe 2:30 in the morning, And our family dog and cats jumped up on my folks' parents' bed upstairs in their bedroom and woke them up, like licked their faces and barked and all that kind of stuff. And so it was like a Lassie story kind of at that moment where my pets really saved my life. They woke them up, got them out of bed, and they sent me to the hospital, maybe, I don't know, 3, 4 in the morning, something like that. And I got my stomach pumped again, but they thought they were too late, that I was already in this kind of brain dead state. I wasn't going to come out of it. My parents then called my sister's high school, got her to come out of high school because they said we're going to start making funeral arrangements. They brought in a priest. I had my last rites read to me in the hospital when I was under life support, and the doctors were just they threw their hands up and they're like, yeah, there's nothing we can do. We're going to have to take him off of life support because he's not going to come out of this. And within 30 minutes of them making that decision or whatever, I don't know, I miraculously came out, and the doctors were shocked. Everybody was shocked. Nobody expected this to happen. And this time, when I came out of it, I had a mem my memory of that was I saw this light at the end of a tunnel, and I'm not kidding about this. It was a light at the end of the tunnel with really small little doctors' faces in that light, and they were asking me, did you do this to yourself? They didn't say who did this to you. They said, did you do this? And I was had given up at that point, and I realized, I can't lie my way out of this, and it didn't even occur to me to even try to tell a lie. So when they said, did you do this? I said, yeah. And the next question was, did you try to kill yourself? And even though it was in a blackout, I knew I was suicidal, and I knew I didn't want to live, and that I was using alcohol as a weapon in this kind of way. So I said, yeah, I did try to kill myself. That's what this was. So funny. I then, lots of doctors and a psychiatrist came in and visited me in the hospital when I was recovering. And I don't really have any clear memory of a lot of these conversations I had, but one of the psychiatrists who talked to me submitted a report to our family physician who ran the ER department. This was at Buffalo General. She ran the ER department, and the psychiatrist gave her a report where he had some conversation with me that I don't remember having. And in his report, he said, he has acute alcoholism. And my doctor didn't believe it because she said, "Well, I never saw him drink anything. That can't be right." But in any case, thank God he did that, and thank God that my parents, and I think in particular my mother, decided that I needed to go to an AA meeting after I got out of the hospital this time. And I maybe because of this shrink's report about me. But we had an old family friend who is in the room here today, Dave P. And Dave P. was an old drinking buddy of my dad's. And I grew up with Dave. He's like an uncle for me, and I knew that Dave had been sober. We had gotten some news that he had gotten sober, I think in 79, maybe it was. So Dave had been sober about 4 or 5 years, and I don't know who it was that called you, Dave. Maybe my mother, I'm assuming, but somebody in one of my parents called Dave and asked Dave to come and pick me up and take me to a meeting. So that's how I got to my first AA meeting. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I'll let, Dave, take me to, his AA meeting, but it's clearly it's not for me. And Dave picked me up and brought me to, the St. Andrew's meeting, which I think is now no longer existing, on Sheridan and, where is it? Sheridan and Elmwood or something like that in Kenmore. And on the car ride over there, Dave said two things to me that have always stuck with me and has been some of the most helpful advice that anyone in AA has given me. And I've actually passed that along to many, many people since then. So I'm going to share it with you now because that's part of my story. He said, first, you're going to be a lot younger than everybody in this meeting. I was 15. I had just turned 15. And he said, don't let that, bother you. Just try to ignore anything that you can't relate to, and focus on the thing that you can identify with. So just try to relate to anything that you hear in the people's stories. Identify, don't compare. And I thought, well, that's easy enough to do. I'll try to do that. And as I was thinking that, I thought, well, I'm just going to tell these people what I think they want me to say. so that I can get, my mother off my back, and so I don't have to go to another one of these meetings again. That was where my thinking was at. I really didn't think, there's no way I could be an alcoholic. So clearly, I have no reason to be here. And as I was thinking that, then Dave said a second thing to me, as if he was reading my mind. He said, "Oh yeah, and by the way, you might as well be honest with these people, because if you're gonna lie to them, they're all gonna know it, because they've just all told the same lies themselves." And that really made sense to me. And for some reason, I believed him. And I believe that it was actually felt to me like it would be a huge relief to finally be honest with somebody. So I took the.
Hey, Chuck. Yep.
Whoa, am I okay on time here? Or we have a Zoom bomber here.
No,
Okay.
you're fine. Keep
Okay.
going.
So I really believe that, and it's a sort of a miracle, I believe that, but it all made sense to me. And so from that day on, I always thought of when I walk into an AA meeting, this is where I'm honest. This is where I practice honesty. Of course, I didn't have much practice at being honest. I didn't know really how to be honest. I thought I was actually a very truthful person, because I knew when I was lying all the time, and so, but because I never told the truth to anybody. But I thought, well, I know the difference between the truth and falsehood. But that really wasn't the case. But anyway, so for me, AA has always been the place where I'm honest, and I'll say also honestly that in that first meeting, I still didn't think AA was really for me, but I saw that they were handing out these free pamphlets about alcoholism, and I thought, well, I'll just take a bunch of these pamphlets, and I'm obviously smarter than everybody in the room, so I'll read these pamphlets, and then I'll convince myself either that I'm not an alcoholic, because the pamphlets will convince me of that. Or if I read the pamphlets or this book that they've got, and it convinces me that I am an alcoholic, well, then I won't have to go to these meetings anymore, because I'll have the pamphlets and I'll have the book, and I can read all that stuff whenever I feel like my life is going downhill again. I'll just have the literature there. But anyway, so after going to a few meetings with Dave, I remember going home one day and saying to my mother, "Okay, I think I'm done with this AA stuff. I don't need it." And she said, just give it another week, just one more week. And I thought, well, okay, well, I'll do that, and to make her happy, so that she leaves me alone. And in that next week, then Dave took me to the University Men's Group, and at that meeting, I heard somebody share, who was much older than me, a different race from me. The differences were pretty extreme, but when he shared and told his story, it was at one of the beginners tables. But when he told his story, I identified with everything he said, and I felt like he was telling my story to me. And so it was that moment where it clicked for me, and I realized I am in the right place. I really do belong here. I am just like the rest of these people. And so that was really what made me stick in AA. And so from the beginning, I realized I need to, any advice that people are going to give me, I'm going to follow that. I was incredibly grateful to even hear, to learn about, as something that I would never have thought would have helped me in my life at that point. But hearing slogans like "This too shall pass" was kind of a miracle for me to hear something like that, because I just thought that every emotional state I was in, whether I was feeling high or low, it was going to last forever. And whatever I was going through in life, whether it was good or bad, it was in the moment, that was what I thought. This is what the rest of my life is going to look like, this. And that's part of the reason why I was so miserable and depressed, in drinking, because every day I woke up, I thought, this is going to be the worst day of my life, and tomorrow is going to be even worse than today. I knew that in advance, almost, right? So this whole idea that my feelings and my relationship to the world can change, and that it can change from minute to minute and hour to hour, was a huge relief. It was a relief to practice honesty. And that did take a lot of practice. And so what I would do is I would sort of make myself share in meetings, because I was trying to tell my story and trying to be honest with myself. And I knew that the only way I could really do it with myself, be honest with myself, was to be honest, with other people in the rooms. I was really relieved also. It was a huge, huge thing for me to realize that, and a relief and a godsend really, to realize that I had a disease like diabetes, and that I could treat that disease, and that this wasn't a moral failing of mine. It wasn't because I was, a bad Catholic or something like that, that I became an alcoholic. Also, when people said, any bit of alcohol, or when the book says too, if you have even the first drink, that's the thing that's gonna, be our downfall. It's not the fifth or the sixth drink or whatever. And so that this idea that alcohol was kind of like bleach or antifreeze or something, where, it's basically just poison for me. To accept that idea was a big, big relief for me, because that took. It helped the desire and the obsession to be removed. I mean, this is how that was removed in my case. Like I said, I didn't have a physical desire or compulsion to drink, but it was a mental obsession for sure. And that was just sort of miraculously taken away from me when the program really worked for me. I was a teenager, and I didn't want to have my life be nothing but, my older adult AA friends. And so I wanted to still be able to go to parties, and I got into playing music in bands, and punk rock bands and things like that. And so I was trying to still do things that other kids did, teenagers in high school. And one of the ways I think I survived that without drinking, or without even feeling the desire to drink, I would go to, parties where kids would have, kegs and things, and they would all be drinking. And this is a character defect of mine, but I know at least at that time in my life, it helped me to stay sober. And it was my pride. My pride. I would go to parties with other kids that I knew from school. I'd see them all getting drunk with a keg. And instead of thinking to myself, who could the alcoholics be? Who could I maybe help here? I was thinking to myself the entire time, they're a bunch of amateurs. They're a bunch of amateurs. I'm the professional here. I know what alcoholism is. I know how to drink way more than any of them knew how to. And my friends are the sober professionals, and I see them all the time, practically every day of the week. And I've got this sort of parallel world. But when I'm with my friends, I just thought of them all as, a bunch of sort of wannabe alcoholics. I didn't see them as potential people I could help. That was, something I regret. But that's how I think I survived that environment as a teenager. And I was very, grateful at the same time to all the support I was getting from folks in the program, who were, old timers. People told me also, stick with the winners. And so I tried to, identify folks that I met in meetings who had long-term sobriety, or who's just, I liked their shares, and I got stuff out of hearing them share. And so I gravitated towards certain folks. But I did stuff in my own kind of sort of half-assed way. So I was, I AA sort of almost quickly for me became something that is a group of friends I thought of that were helping me. I did a little bit of service here and there, in terms of, like, I would chair meetings, or I would be the literature rep or whatever. I'd make coffee. I did a little bit of step work. Dave P was my first sponsor. And I didn't, I knew I'm supposed to have a sponsor. I'm supposed to do stuff like this. And so I tried in my own kind of half-assed way to do that. I remember, though, certain steps, when I tried to do like eighth and ninth step with Dave, he probably has no recollection of this, but I do. I remember I didn't have much to write in those columns, because I thought, well, the only people I affected with my drinking or hurt was my immediate family. And so I thought, well, I don't have many people to make amends to. And because I hear people talking about making living amends, I just thought, well, that's how I'll make my amends to my family. I'll just stay sober. And, my parents would always tell me, we're just happy you're not drinking. We're just happy you're not drinking. So just keep doing what you're doing. And so I thought, that. So that was kind of how I did the steps my first time through. I also kind of thought, well, I don't just need to have one sponsor. I can think of, all my friends in AA as kind of like, co-sponsoring me. And so I didn't really work closely with Dave or with anybody who sponsored me back then. I also, thought, when I heard people say stick with the winners, that meant sort of stay away from the newcomers, or at least I didn't know that that's what I didn't know that that's what it meant. But when newcomers would come to the meeting, I would immediately assume I don't have anything to help them with. I'm 16 years old or whatever. How am I supposed to help somebody who's coming from what was that place, that at Gates Circle, that Bry Lynn place, I think it was called. It was a detox place. They would have a van that would bring people to the meeting twice a week. They were all, a couple decades older than me or a decade older than me. And I just thought, I can't help newcomers like this. I can't share my experience, strength, and hope with them, because I can, obviously I can, they can help me. They can help me to stay sober, but I didn't think I had any tools really, or my experience, strength, and hope wasn't quite where it needed to be, or something like that, to help them. So I didn't realize that just the fact that I was an alcoholic, it didn't matter my age, the fact that they could identify with me, in spite of the differences, in the same way that I could do that with them when I first came in. I didn't realize that it could work as a two-way street. I just thought that I got this kind of notion stuck in my head that AA is a one-way street, that I get help from other people, and I can't really give a whole much a whole bunch back in return. So you can imagine that the promise that we read out loud when we read the promises about that feeling of uselessness will go away or will disappear. I started to actually get more and more of a feeling of uselessness in AA, only because of this idea that I got in my mind that I just can't help other people. I can't help people older than me. And it didn't occur to me to help anybody younger than me, because I just didn't see them in the meetings. So all of that sort of led to me eventually sort of drifting away from AA. And it was a long, long process. When I left Buffalo, I went to Baltimore for graduate school. And immediately I didn't kind of like the style of AA in Baltimore. It was a little bit different there. I'm not that much different, but different enough for me, because my head was already starting to go elsewhere. And so I used that as an excuse to cut back on the amount of meetings I was going to. I still went to meetings, but not as often. Then I went to Europe, and I lived in Europe for a couple of years, and that's where I really sort of got out of the habit of going to meetings. I tried to in Germany. They were so different from anything I was used to that I just thought, forget this. I started participating in some online, like email lists kind of meetings. Those kind of got kind of weird and fell apart, and I didn't really like that. So I just thought, well, I'll just stay sober by keeping in touch with my Buffalo AA friends and try to make do without meetings in any way. But when I got back from Europe a few years later, I felt that it was much easier for me to get kind of in a critical mindset about AA when I did go to meetings in Baltimore. I went to fewer and fewer, and so over the pr Of course, of maybe I would say 9 years or so, I just cut back slower, less and less and less, to the point where when I left Baltimore for my first job in New Mexico, I didn't go to any meetings anymore. I didn't even bother to look up a meeting schedule or contact the central office where I was in New Mexico. I just decided I'd graduated. So A from AAA was a chapter of my past. It was closed. I still have my higher power. I still have God. I still know I'm an alcoholic. The saying in the big book, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I never had any doubts about that. I had my sort of antifreeze or bleach theory about alcohol, so I didn't feel a desire to drink ever, or any kind of temptation to. But I thought, I got to focus on my career now. I met the woman that became my wife. We ended up, having a son, and I just thought, well, my life has to move on now. And it's funny because almost within within the first year, or maybe even 6 months of not going to any meetings at all back in the States, I got convinced that I needed psychoanalysis. Where did this come from? I had no idea, but I thought, I need to see a therapist. And so I started to do psychoanalysis in 2005. I did that for 6 years, from 2005 to 2011. And I felt like my life was getting on more and more unmanageable. I'd forgotten to talk about my character defects as character defects. I didn't I, that kind of language, or that way of treating character defects that I learned in AA. I had forgotten all about that. And so they started to kind of like come back and hijack my life. I like to think that I was a sort of almost like a hijack victim of that. I got into, say, political activism. I discovered that I could be self-righteously angry, and I could legitimize it, or I could justify that through political activism. And what I was really, justifying for myself, I see, I saw in hindsight was, I was just starting to live on dry benders, and I really started to feel like a dry drunk because of that. And I started to feel like I was fighting everybody. I also, in the middle of this time when I wasn't going to meetings, I had this kind of religious reawakening, or this spiritual reawakening, where I rediscovered my faith that I grew up with, and I started to read the Bible for the first time. And the thing that really kind of blew me away was I read the Psalms for the first time in my life, and that kind of blew my mind. And I thought, when I read the Psalms, I thought, that's my life right there, not just as an alcoholic, but in recovery, and that's my life today. And so yeah, I could really identify with that, but that wasn't enough. A religious reawakening, or a sort of rediscovery of my faith, wasn't enough to help me feel like my life was manageable in some way. So I was doing all sorts of insane things in this period, and it got to a point where I just felt like, I hated everybody at my job. I was fighting everything and everybody, and one day I had to kill some time in a library, a public library, while a bike shop was fixing my bike. I looked up at a shelf in the library, and there was a big book up there. And I thought, hey, I'll look at that. I haven't looked at that in maybe 15 years or 20 years. So I cracked open the big, and I had never read the whole thing, by the way. I'd gotten up to like page 50, because I decided it wasn't for me. But I cracked it open, and I'm not making this up. I cracked it open randomly, and my eyes drifted down the page, and the first sentence I saw was, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone." It's in the chapter Into Action, on the 10th step. And I was amazed, because I thought at that moment, I wanted to kill everybody at my job. I didn't want to see anybody, and I was really angry at the entire world. And when I saw that sentence, I thought, wow, they have the answer. And I rushed home after I got my bike. I took out my old little 24-hour a day prayer and meditation book. I looked up the entry for that day. It's May 3rd. Read May 3rd. It's the best entry in the entire 24-hour day book, and it's about resentment and anger. And I just thought, I need a meeting as quick as possible. I found one, two blocks away from my house, meeting that night. I walked over to it. It was a big book meeting, and I walked in, and I had this feeling that that I was with old friends. I didn't know any of these people, but I thought that they knew me, and I knew them, and they could finish my sentences, and I could finish their sentences. It was a really incredible feeling, and so I realized at that moment that AA needed me to be there, and just as much as I needed AA to be there, and I was really grateful that they were there. I immediately asked myself, what was I doing, half-stepping the first time I did this? And so I got a sponsor right away. I started working the steps again. I read the entire big book like that weekend. And I just, I started doing step work in an ongoing way, doing service, working with newcomers. I sponsored my very first person that I ever sponsored. A month later, I was giving out my number to newcomers, doing everything that I didn't do the first time around. I was grateful to Dave and Chuck for sending me the step action outline that I started using with people I sponsored. And then when COVID hit, I got really into going to German language online meetings, and I translated that step action outline. Some of you probably know that meeting or that format. I translated the whole thing into German. And back in 2021, and started an online German version of Step Action, and so that's been going strong now for about 4.5 years. So for me today, I know my time is running out, but I realized how grateful I was when I got back to that meeting, when I got back to the fellowship, and it was right around the corner for me. Pittsburgh's got an amazing fellowship, lots of great meetings. But I realized that if I'm grateful for this, the best way I can kind of express that gratitude is by doing service work, and trying to do as much 12-step work as I could. And the other big realization for me was the idea that I'm not useless. And who am I to judge my own usefulness? Only God can be the judge of that. And anything I say or do, in a meeting is potentially useful to somebody. And so that's almost like a 13th step I came to believe in. After I came to believe in a higher power, I came to believe, this time around at least, in something that I like to think of as my potentially usefulness. So I'm still growing up a lot. I got a lot of growing up to do in AA, but with all of your help and the grace of God, I'm able to stay sober today. And so thanks for being here and thanks for hearing my story. I'm sorry I didn't stop earlier, but I just had a lot of ground to cover. But